Day glow, flashing lights, special effects. Today's world puts our sense of sight on overload. Luckily, there are places we can go to refocus our senses. Our national wildlife refuges. It's a wonder how much you'll see once all the distractions fade away. You may see a lone eagle soaring past massive snow-capped mountains, or a great horned owl perched stoically on a branch nearby. You may see the furry face of a baby sea otter curiously poking its head out of the dark blue sea, or ancient rocks shaped by centuries of wind. When you see these things, you're seeing the world the way we found it. With over 500 refuges across America, you don't have to go far to make a special connection with nature. Learn more at fws.gov/refuges. That's fws.gov/refuges.
WebAdvisor, a program allowing students and staff access to college-related information. Through WebAdvisor, you are able to register for classes, view grades, track financial aid, print class schedules, and much more. Log into WebAdvisor by going to my.hfcc.edu/webadvisor or from the homepage hfcc.edu.
Ever have this conversation with yourself? Local news and alternative views. I know. You don't know. I know what I need to know. You don't know enough. I read news on the internet. You don't know local. I check into Facebook a lot. You don't know facts. I watch television news. You don't know in depth. I read the local newspapers. Better, but you still don't know background analysis, the real voices of the newsmakers. Then what should I do to really know local news and alternative views? You need to listen to the new WHFR Journal, broadcast live Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, or get their podcast from www.whfr.fm. So, now I'll know.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the Donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon.
Our thinking originates at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I both teach philosophy.
Today's program is part of Pacific University's 16th Annual Undergraduate Philosophy Conference. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today we're going to ask the question, often asked, why be moral?
Well, isn't that kind of a dumb question? I mean, morality is, by definition, a good thing. Immorality, a bad thing. A person should do good things and not do bad things. Don't you agree? Doesn't everyone agree?
Well, if you judge people by their behavior, I don't think everyone does, in fact, agree, Josh.
Well, that's because you're confusing ought and is. People do, in fact, behave immorally. That's is. But they shouldn't. That's ought. It's not reasonable. Everyone knows that, at least in their heart of hearts.
Oh, saying that implies that when people behave immorally, they're acting irrationally or insincerely or hypocritically or something like that. But look, there could be situations in which a person fully weighs the pros and cons, sincerely and rationally decides that the best thing for him to do, all things considered, is precisely what morality forbids. Don't you think so?
Well, I take it you're thinking of situations in which morality points you in one direction and your own self-interest points you in another direction.
That's one thing I'm thinking of, yeah, right?
Well, I mean, that happens. Lots of people are psychologically inclined, for one reason or another, to elevate their own self-interest above all other considerations, including morality. For people like that, when morality and self-interest come into conflict, reason won't convince them to go with the moral choice. It loses out. But that's not how they should reason. Rationally speaking, morality should always trump self-interest.
Rationally speaking? Are you kidding me? Look, suppose there's an open, unguarded bank vault with lots and lots and lots of cash. It's staring you in the face. It's ripe for the taking. And you could really, really use that money, John. And look, I'm going to add something else to this scenario. I'm going to give you an ironclad guarantee that if you take it, no one will ever be the wiser. Where's a rationality in not taking the money? Come on, show me where the rationality is.
Well, I think the problem here is, Ken, that you're a moral skeptic. You don't really believe in objective right and wrong. Well, if there's no objective right and wrong, we can do whatever we want without having to worry about morality, then it's probably not rational to worry about it. But that's a pretty desperate position, isn't it?
Well, look, I think there's actually a lot to be said for moral skepticism. I have to admit, you kind of called me out there, but look, for the sake of this argument, I don't need that. I'm willing to stipulate that it would be wrong, morally wrong, to take the money in the situation we just imagined. I'm even willing to stipulate that that's an objective, inescapable fact. I'm willing to stipulate all that.
Well, if you stipulate all that, where's the problem?
Well, the question still remains. Does the bare fact that something is objectively, morally right or wrong, does that automatically give you a reason to do it or not do it?
I think I'm seeing where you're coming from. You think that the only thing we ever have a reason to do is to pursue our own self-interest. But that's not right. You should admit that there's more to rationality than just figuring out what's in our own self-interest.
Well, I admit that. Look, I go to the doctor, I have this disease. There's a drug that would cure the disease. The doctor gives it to me. Why does he give it to me? Because he cares about my well-being. And he does that. He's acting out of my interests, not his own interests, at least not exclusively. And I agree, he's acting rationally. So I think you're right. Behaving rationally doesn't just mean acting in your own self-interest. I agree.
So self-regarding reasons are rooted in considerations of naked self-interest. You distinguish from those other regarding interests that are not rooted in self-interest, but in our concern for others. So we got two kinds of reasons. Morality may not always give us self-regarding reasons to do what it commands, but that doesn't mean it doesn't give us reasons, because it could give us other regarding reasons. So it seems to me we've solved your problem.
No, problem not solved, because there's now a further question. How do we balance self-regarding reasons against other regarding reasons when the two conflict? I mean, who says that the altruistic other regarding reasons always win out? Who says that?
Well, you know, any philosopher who says there's something they don't understand always trumps a philosopher who thinks they do understand it. So you really think there's a question there, so there must be a question there. Lots of people believe that moral considerations always override selfish concerns, but you don't, so we can ask, why do they?
Plus, there's another thing. Look, there are people who don't care a whit about the well-being of others. They may be selfish in the extreme. I admit they're selfish in the extreme, but are they irrational? And if you can be totally self-regarding and still be rational, those other regarding considerations that morality throws at you, they'll just fail to move you. They'll fail to move you rationally.
You know, that reminds me of Hume. Hume had this selfish, rational knave, some poor soul that had been raised without proper parenting, so he didn't really have any connection with other people. He didn't care about satisfying their desires, and he wasn't moved by issues of morality. And Hume said that person could be a perfectly consistent thinker, not make errors of logic, and yet there might be nothing you could say that would convince him to be moral. Well, I mean, I agree. If that's the narrow definition of morality, I think the best thing to do with such people is to avoid them.
Well, look, these are challenging questions, John, that we've asked. And to help us get started in our search for answer, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to find out how supposedly moral people rationalize their immoral behavior. She files this report.
Mark Pierpont is a complicated man. He was an evangelical preacher who became well known for trying to cure gay people. He'd hang out at gay bars and distribute religious pamphlets. Here's a clip from an old interview Pierpont gave, shown in the documentary film The Protagonist.
Is homosexuality a sin, a vitamin deficiency, or?
Oh, it's definitely a sin. It's just the same as stealing, lying, anything. It's a sin. It's a bondage. It's different in the fact that the scripture says a man who commits sexual sin commits it against the body itself. And so in that way, it's worse because it's a deeper bondage. It's all-encompassing, spirit, soul, and body.
Of course, this story is complicated by the fact that Mark Pierpont is gay. So this raises the question, can you be both gay and an evangelical preacher who denounces homosexuality? Which part of your identity is the more authentic, the gay part or the religious part?
We were interested in the question about what people think a person is like really deep down inside, and we were wondering whether it'd be influenced by people's moral judgments.
Joshua Knobe is an experimental philosopher at Yale. He conducts thought experiments on real people while studying their behavior and their brains. In one experiment, he divided 200 participants into two groups. The first group heard the story of the real Mark Pierpont, the man caught between his desires and his moral beliefs.
And what we asked participants is just, what is Pierpont's true self?
The results were pretty clearly split along ideological lines. Liberals believed Pierpont's true self is in his feelings, that he's gay. And conservatives said Pierpont's true self is in his moral beliefs, that he's Christian. Then a second group of participants heard a story that was the exact reverse, where a man preaches homosexuality as a virtue.
He kept having these feelings that told him, you know, this is wrong, there's something kind of disgusting about engaging in these kind of behaviors. And then participants were asked, okay, there are these two parts of himself. Which is his true self?
This time, the results were the exact opposite. Liberals said Pierpont's moral beliefs are his true self, that deep down he's a man who believes it's wrong to sexually discriminate. And conservatives said his feelings, that homosexuality is a sin, were his true self, not his moral beliefs. So what does this all mean?
When a person has all sorts of different aspects of their self, we pick out whichever aspect of the self we think is truly the valuable one, the good one, and we regard that one as being the person's essence, sort of who that person most fundamentally is.
This impulse to believe that people have good in them and say that's who they really are seems kind of sweet to me. But then, as Joshua Knobe points out, it's also judgmental and unforgiving. Like, we can't see people as being morally good if they're different. Knobe says studies have shown that when people believe they're morally good, that actually causes them to act in terrible ways.
They seem to feel licensed by the fact that they are so morally good in general to sort of slack off on this one particular occasion.
So we see people who drive Priuses flying down to L.A. for an afternoon of shopping, or the morally righteous guy making an off-color racist joke. If we're so prone to moral hypocrisy, what makes us act good in the first place?
One of the most striking things is the enormous, enormous effect of feeling like you're being watched. When people are completely alone, they feel perfectly content to do things that harm others in ways that they would never do if they in any way felt like other people were watching them.
Studies show people are more likely to act good or altruistically if there's a picture with eyes on it that seems to be watching them. Knobe says if you want people to leave money in that tip jar, perhaps you should add a picture of a face. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Experimental philosophy, reasons people give for being moral and reasons they give for being immoral. Thank you, Caitlin Esch, our roving philosophical reporter. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon.
And our guest today is a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He's a very prolific author, in particular, From Rationality to Equality. James Sterba, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
So, James, how did you get interested in this topic of why we should be moral?
Well, it's an important question for philosophy, and I looked around the world, and well, my experience, I saw a lot of people behaving very immorally, and I thought, if I could give a strong justification for morality, I might be able to make a difference. So that's been my project.
And how's that worked out for you?
Well...
The question, why be moral, is a deep and difficult philosophical question that thinkers since Plato have struggled with, and Hume struggled with it, I guess. But is it really the kind of question that ordinary people go around asking themselves, or should they go around asking themselves?
Well, not all the time, but there's certain times in people's lives where morality seems to require some significant demands of them, and it conflicts with their self-interest. They can wonder whether they really have most reason to behave morally rather than behave self-interestedly. They can worry that they've been somehow maybe sold a bill of goods if they would behave morally. So they want an answer.
So, I mean, is morally really so demanding that it can really demand? Give me an example in which morality requires you to go against your own self-interest. Give me an example. I mean, because morality should always be in our self-interest. It's in our enlightened self-interest, so the conflict isn't really possible.
Look at rich and poor in the United States today. Is it in the interest of the rich to take a 10% tax and transfer the resources to the poor? I don't think they think of it as in their interest, but I think it's morally required.
Would you distinguish between, just want to get clear about this conflict between morality and self-interest, would you distinguish between sort of narrow self-interest, enlightened self-interest, and morality? Some people think morality is just a matter of enlightened self-interest. Why isn't it just a matter of enlightened self-interest?
Well, go back to the rich-poor situation. Are the rich not really understanding what's in their best self-interest when they resist tax increases? Or are they really speaking, yes, it really is in their interest to keep all that wealth and have a good time with it. But morality says the poor needs have to be met.
This enlightened self-interest stuff strikes me as a little bit of wishful thinking, that somehow if you do the right thing, it will always rebound to your own benefit. But that ain't so.
So the conflict between morality and self-interest, even enlightened self-interest, is real and deep. And because self-interest moves us so powerfully, this is a really hard conflict, right?
And that's why we need a strong argument for the rationality of morality over self-interest in those conflict situations.
So we're going to dig into why that's so. Give me a little hint. I mean, self-interest moves us powerfully. Morality seems like you're painting it as a weak read.
Yeah, give
us. Is it a weak read or is it a powerful read?
Give us a one-sentence argument here.
Well, I mean,
just kidding.
I guess the basic thrust here is, I mean, you're not going to be able to show that the immoral person is irrational or crazy or stupid. Rich people who don't want to give their money to the poor are not stupid, crazy. But they are irrational in another sense. That is, I don't think they can give a good argument why they should hold on to their wealth and the poor who have much greater need should not have a share of it.
Well, we're going to challenge you on that and see if that's right. But this is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Pacific University in Forest Grove. Our guest is James Sterva from the University of Notre Dame. We're asking, why be moral?
Morality sometimes does make demands on us. Are those demands always reasonable? Are they always the most reasonable thing we should do? Should morality always trump self-interest, no matter what?
The demands of morality versus the demands of self-interest, along with questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones, for their delightful, sensitive, and moving homage to David Hume's Rational Knave. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking, why be moral, with James Sterva from the University of Notre Dame.
We want our audience of young philosophers to chime in. Being moral often demands that we put our own self-interest aside. Many people believe the demands of morality are always more compelling than the demands of self-interest. But what, if anything, makes that true? You can join the discussion by stepping up to the microphones on either side of the stage.
So look, James, here's one way that you might think that morality always gets to override self-interest. You might think it's something like this. Well, look, the demands of morality are the demands of reason itself. And self-interest comes from, you know, these passions and appetites and desires, and they don't get to make any demands on us. That's kind of what Kant and, and Plato seem to think. I mean, do you think that's the right way to think about it, that passions and desires and appetites don't make any rational demands on us,
well,
and morality speaks for reason itself?
On your first point, that morality always overrides reasons of self-interest, I don't think that's correct. I think morality sometimes requires us to act in our self-interest, and sometimes requires us to act in the interests of others.
Okay, when morality and self-interest compete,
yes,
morality always wins, many people think.
But that's because morality itself is already a compromise between self-interest and altruism. So we wouldn't want to have self-interest win twice, a compromise after we've compromised within morality.
Well, look, I'm just a poor philosopher of language, and these ethical arguments get over my head pretty quick. Let's go back to Ken's example. I come across $100.
It was $100 million.
Well, let's say $100. It's obviously been left behind on a subway bench by somebody who probably needs it. On the other hand, nobody's going to see me just take it. The right thing to do is turn it in to the lost and found,
right,
at the subway station. Is that in my enlightened self-interest? No, I don't delude myself to think that,
right,
God's keeping track, or Santa Claus, or that, you know, good deeds always redound to one's good luck. I think my self-interest is to take the $100 and, you know, take my wife out to dinner for a change and fill the car with gas, or these days fill the car halfway with gas. Now, how does this theory that you've been explaining with these highfalutin words apply to that? Why should I be moral?
Let's just change the example just a little bit. Suppose you saw
a poor person
dropping the $100 yeah. bill as they got off the subway, and now the question is, do you keep the $100 when no one else saw that you picked it up?
And so, well, I could chase the poor person.
You could,
back
you could.
Yeah.
And now the question is, do you have a good argument for favoring your own interests here, your luxury interests, using $100 in a fancy restaurant, or giving the money back to the poor person? Do you have a non-question-begging argument for favoring your interests over the poor person's interests? I think you don't.
Well, I don't know what that criteria looks. Suppose I just care about myself, and I don't care about poor people. You know, I'm a cold-hearted person,
yes,
but that's how I am,
yes,
and I can still have reasons, even though I'm a cold-hearted person. So I don't. Where is this non-question-begging argument?
Wait a minute. We don't have to give up so quick. I think I've got a good argument. I don't know anything about that person. I know quite a bit about myself. He's a poor person. I'm a college professor,
right,
so there's a little bit of difference there.
Right.
But I know that I do good things with money. Right.
You're
going to
take your wife off to the dinner.
I'm going to take my wife out to dinner. Well, you don't know that my wife actually is quite hungry.
Hasn't eaten.
I'm going to pay my grandkids' book bill at college. So I have good reason to think that the money will be made good use of by me, serving my interests, even where my interests extend to helping others. I don't have any more than a 50-50 reason to believe that it'll be made good use of by him. So why isn't that a good argument for doing
yeah,
what I want to do?
Excellent, John.
Look, you made yourself now a needy college professor, and now we're comparing.
No, God made me a needy college
professor. No, wait a minute. Slow down. He did not make himself a needy college professor. He made himself a college professor with certain ends and aims, certain things he cares about, certain goods he wants to do.
He had his wife who was starving. I mean, this was a needy college professor.
I'm a college professor to whom $100 means a certain amount of marginal ability to do good things.
And I had the person who dropped it to be this shabby-looking person that looks like they really are in tough straits. And now I want to say, what's the good argument for favoring your interests over the interests of that poor person?
Okay, suppose I say, okay, I grant you in that case there isn't one, but now let's increase the poor person's income by $5 a year, and to cut it short, we'll get it up to $200,000 a year, which is more than I earn. You know, matter of fact, it's a rich guy with a suit made to order and Italian shoes, and
now
he dropped
$100. Now it doesn't matter.
It's still the right thing to give him the $100.
I'm not sure at that point.
Are you saying my grandmother didn't have this straight?
Look, it would be nice to give him back. I don't think you did anything horribly wrong in not giving him back.
Can we dial this back a little bit?
Yeah.
I want to get something more basic. So my self-interest can weigh some, right?
Yes.
The considerations of others can weigh some.
Yes.
Morality can come in there and say
compromise.
Your self-interest matters, but his well-being in this case matters more.
Right.
Now, what I don't understand is, how does morality get to say that to me?
Well, because for any individual, we can sort of talk about things that are really important for that person's self-interest and things that are not very important. And then we can talk about that with respect to other people as well, things that are very important for their self-interest and things that are not very important. And so the idea of what morality does is when you have a self-interested reason, it's not very important, and other people have a reason, I would call, for you, with respect to you, it's an altruistic reason that's very important. It may be very important to their lives that you say the altruistic reason that favoring others over trumps your low-ranking self-interested reason. And when you have a high-ranking self-interested reason, that trumps low-ranking altruistic reasons for others.
Well, I think you understand this. We're going to work it out over a number of examples, but I see we've got quite a line,
yes,
Ken, of people ready to ask short, penetrating, deep, profound, succinct questions.
So why don't we take some questions from our live audience? We're talking about why be moral in front of an audience at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Nan.
Thank you. My name is Samantha Schroeder from the University of Central Florida in Orlando, Florida. In the Christian religion, you often find many older believers who espouse their Augustinian confessions. Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. So there's this idea of the greater sin that you experience in your youth, the greater goodness or virtue you arrive at when you get older. So that being considered, are there circumstances in which it is necessary or good to, so to speak, teleologically suspend the ethical for greater moral knowledge or goodness in the long run?
Wow. Good question.
Yeah. And, think about that one, James.
Yeah. I love that she quoted my favorite prayer, St. Augustine's, give me chastity, but not yet.
I mean, if we're talking about trivial issues, trivial moral requirements, maybe. But anything significant, no. Remember, morality is not going against self-interest all the time. It's just going to go against self-interest in certain situations where the strong interests of others are at stake. And at that point, there should be no exception. Reason will not justify making an exception there.
Bertrand Russell was fired from UCLA for advocating that college students should live together before getting married because he thought in the long run this would lead to stronger marriages. Would you say that was an instance of what the young lady had in mind? Gross immorality when you're young, but for a greater good?
I wouldn't call it gross immorality at all. So okay. There's no problem.
So welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi. I'm Sam Gomes from Humboldt State University, California. I'm a philosophy major, and I'm a bit disturbed by how quickly you dismissed enlightened self-interest. I think that doesn't morality form a basis for society which benefits everybody? If I recall, this is what Darwin actually postulated.
Just a factual question. What's the biggest product in Humboldt County?
I do not recall.
So he's wondering, I mean, some people really do want to reduce morality to enlightened self-interest, and so there could not be this conflict. He thinks you too quickly. What do you?
Well, I mean, look around the world. Do you think people's real self-interest is not in conflict? Do you think the real self-interest of rich people in the world are not in conflict with the interest of poor people? I would love to that be the case. It really would be a better world to live with, that we could mutual benefit. Everyone would mutually benefit. No one would have to take any losses. But I don't think that's the real world. I think the real world is where, if we're going to help people that are poor and needy, we're going to have to make sacrifices. And I think that's the way it is.
Let me give you an example. Take me. So I'm not rich, but I'm perfectly well off. And if I take a $1,000 deduction on my taxes for money donated to Oxfam, that's a good thing to do and in my self-interest. But it's even more in my self-interest just to take the deduction and not send the money, because these days the government's so strapped they can't afford to audit very many income taxes. But I think that's wrong, right? I don't think there's any particular guarantee that doing the right thing will come back and help me as much as that $1,000 deduction.
It would be really easy if morality and enlightened self-interest always overlap. That would just be an easy world to live in, but the world isn't that easy. But we've got more questions. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
A good lead-in. You brought it back to what I was originally going to ask. My name is Rick Smoody. I'm from across the river in Vancouver. I'm not a philosophy major. I'm a computer geek. A lot of things are not binary, that things are more moral, less moral. For example, I bet you almost everyone here has told a lie at some point, even though we recognize that in the abstract that it's immoral, and yet we do it sometimes. And sometimes it's the right thing to do, not only for our own self-interest, but it's what society would expect of us to do.
Society expects us to be immoral. And it may be, but that doesn't make it right just because society expects it. I mean, lots of societies have expected people to do lots of things, and a lot of those things have been immoral. Some of them have not been. But I don't think we want to ground everything on what society happens to expect.
Well, I mean, just take a hypothetical case. Suppose you're a national candidate running for the presidency, and you think you becoming president would be an extraordinarily good thing for the world, for the nation, rich and poor alike. But it's required to do so that you lie. Now, should you think of that as lying and therefore being immoral, or should you think of it as a case in which lying isn't immoral?
I think I would go the latter route. I don't think that, you know, you're always bound in all circumstances to tell the truth. You know, a threatening person comes up to the door and says, "Where is your mother?" I don't think you should tell him. This is it. Don't tell the truth.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Nikki Arate from Portland State University. My question's kind of asking about the context in which people make judgments. So assuming there's a universal or objective morality, can we distinguish between individual and cultural morality? And if so, in the case of the top 1% paying their fair share of taxes, could you say that a particular cultural context itself could be immoral, leaving little room for individual morality?
In other words, the whole situation's such a rotten mess that it
doesn't make much
sense to criticize individuals.
Criticize morality on a cultural level before you criticize the individuals.
We always start with some starting point. We're in some cultural situation, and we begin with the prejudices of that situation. But our goal here is, if we're trying to make moral judgments, is to break out from that. I mean, we start with a situation about prejudice against women. And we watch how this thing has developed in the course of America, and we broke it out of that cultural prejudice. Not far enough yet, but we're moving in the right direction. So, you know, there's cultural presuppositions that are operating, and then they subject to critical assessment, and they change.
That's true. Let's let some more questions in here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Patrick Anderson. I'm from Grand Valley State University. René Descartes famously tried to offer a foundation for philosophy, but he was particularly concerned about knowledge. I was wondering if philosophers have historically tried to offer some type of foundation for ethics, and my question is, does ethics need this foundation, and is it possible to come up with a foundation?
Well, James can answer the factual question without any interference from us.
the problem here is that philosophers have wanted an answer to this, and the reason why they wanted an answer to it, they wanted an argument that morality was rationally required, and they haven't been able to come up with it until my argument.
Yes.
And I can explain, they haven't been stupid about this. I can explain why they didn't see a certain move. Once you make a certain move, then my argument becomes possible. But look, there's a reason why we want this, because if it turns out that it's just as rational to be moral as to be immoral, then what are our grounds for punishing people who behave immoral, who do unlawful things? What's our grounds if we can't give an argument in terms of rationality for it?
Why not power? Why not our own self-interest? Oh. Why not our desire to control the other and all that?
We thought we had something better than power. See, we always contrasted morality with power. I mean, you know, power was never going to be the final bottom line for what we do.
Going back to Plato, morality is not just what's in the interest of the stronger.
Right.
Right, but that's true, and that's our dream. And the question is,
do we have an argument?
Do we have an argument? Can we make that dream good? And that's why we're asking the question, why be moral? Because we want some rational answer to it.
But our next questioner is going to give us the rational answer to it.
welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Yeah, hi. My name is Ryan Hofer. I'm a graduate student at Portland State University, and I'm wondering, how does moral luck play into all this? For example, if I drive home with a blood alcohol level of 0.06 for years and years and years, and then one night I decide to have one more philosophical discussion with my buddies, and everything happens to line up in the universe to where I hit an animal or another person on my way home. We can't predict the consequences of all our actions, so how does luck play into being moral and the assessment of morality?
Do you have an answer?
You were doing wrong all along. You were risking danger to other people even before you caused an actual
harm to people. I mean, and the law makes a difference between sort of risky behavior and actual harm. And so we give a stronger penalty for the harm. If we found out you had the blood alcohol even before you harmed anybody, we punish you for that too.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, why be moral? With James Sturba from the University of Notre Dame.
In our final segment, we'll consider the idea of moral disagreement. If morality is really based on reason, like James thinks it is and Ken thinks it better be, if it amounts to anything, why is there so much disagreement? When it comes to morality, does reason speak with one voice or many voices?
We're coming to you from the 16th Annual Undergraduate Philosophy Conference at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Let's hear it for our live musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking, why be moral? Our guest is James Sturba, author of From Rationality to Equality. We've got lots more questions from our audience here at Pacific University. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, my name is Kelly Bile. I'm from the University of Oregon. And I want to make the case that we as human beings don't live in a vacuum, and that often there are different factors that often play into our moral decisions. So maybe could you speak to like social, political, historical factors that could sometimes influence moral character or moral behavior?
Is it that you think that what counts as moral in one context, because of these different factors, may count as not count as moral in a different context? Is
yeah.
that kind of where you're at?
Yeah.
So it's kind of
a relativism question.
Yeah. Relativism.
Yeah. Well, I actually don't think that the relativism issue, that there's a defense of moral relativism. I think that usually what's going on when you deal with what apparently are moral relativism cases is you don't have a conflict between two judgments of where people are actually thinking about morality. Now, what does that mean? I mean, you know, people can't just say anything is I have a moral judgment here. To make a moral judgment, you have to be taking the interests of everybody into account fairly. That's what making a moral judgment means. If you think, well, my mother told me this on her knee, and that, therefore I morally think this is the right thing, that's not good enough. It must ultimately go back to, does it take everybody's interest to account fairly? And that's what morality
is. So look, now I understand that there are people who believe that kind of thing about morality. It's a deep and important philosophical tradition that says what you're saying. But here's a thought. I don't know if I believe this in my heart of hearts, but here's a thought. You know, how much your well-being, your good counts with me, that's highly contingent on what I think about you. I mean, look, take the Greeks and the barbarians. The Greeks, the barbarians have some interest, but they don't weigh as much as the interest of a Greek. The slave owners thought, the slaves have some interest, but they don't weigh as much.
And they were wrong.
But I know, you think they were wrong. Okay, I know God could tell you that.
No,
you're from Notre Dame, and I know maybe the Pope said.
No.
But suppose you and I disagree about this. Goes back to our question of whether reason speaks with one voice or if it's a cacophony when it comes to matters of morality. I think I'm perfectly rational, one might think, to think that the interests of the barbarians count less than the interests of the Greeks. Convince me by reasoned argument that I'm wrong.
Well, I think what happens is over time this prejudice gets unraveled. And that eventually Greeks subsequently realize the humanity of barbarians and so make alliances.
Focusing too much on the particular example.
All right.
Whether everybody, you said morality requires you to count everybody's interest equally.
Fairly.
I wonder why
No, not equally.
Fairly, that's right. You did say fairly.
Yes.
I wonder where that comes from. Is that just something you intuitively know, or is that like a first principle of reason or just, or what is that?
Well, if you don't mean that by morality, what do you mean? I mean, if you just mean I think something ought to be done, or I think I ought to do this, well, that can, self-interest can be
what I think I ought to do. Usually what happens with morality is morality takes into account other people's interests. And then the question is, well, does it take account anyway? It'd be other people are worth two-fifths of a person? Well, that's one way of taking other people's interests account. But no, it takes it into account fairly. That's the goal. You know, if you're not making judgments on the basis of everybody that could be affected by your action, then you're not making a moral judgment. If you're making it just for a special group of people, that's a special interest judgment.
Another question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yes, hi. My name is Edward Erschbach. I attend some philosophy talks here in Portland called Socrates Cafes. My question is, it seems like the dialogue has been framed in like a transcendent, static fashion to talk about morality. But I think that, you know, there's this one journalist who like videotaped a child being eaten by a vulture in a country, and you know, he was doing the journalistic thing to be objective, but then he felt great moral grief about not stepping in and just saving the child. And so I wonder if anxiety is the basis of morality. Like, if you're not anxious, maybe you're kind of a worthless person.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me like you have kind of a quasi-Humean theory of morality, which is a rich theory, that morality is based on our sentiments and fellow feeling and all that. And I think that's an important insight. But here's another uncomforting, discomforting fact. Human fellow feeling and sentiment and sympathy runs out. It runs out all the time, all over the world. The Tutus, the Hutsis, the Nazis, it just runs out all over the world. And if you think the actual extent of human sympathy and sentiment actually determines the moral right and wrong, I think you're going to be embarrassed by it.
I'll try to phrase this as a question to James. I don't think that's quite what Hume thought. Hume thought you took a detached, well-brought-up person, and their reactions to a situation not directly involving them are kind of the ground data on which morality is built, and that we have a natural human sympathy, and if it's developed, will work out, but, you know, lots of people don't have it. Now, your view seems to be more Kantian, more reason. Hume's famous thing was, Ken will get it right, reason is and ought to be a slave of the passions.
Right.
Yeah. So in his theory of morality, the passion was the sympathy for others, this fellow feeling for others.
Well,
But you don't rely on that?
Well, I do rely on that in the sense that the requirements of morality are dependent on people being capable of being moral. And it's part of the sentiment issue is part of the capabilities. And one of the reasons why Hume thought that you could rely on sentiment, he thought that the people's sentiments just coalesced very nicely, that it was really ultimately everyone's self-interest to be moral. Well, if I thought that was the case, I wouldn't have a problem with reason either. We just follow sentiment.
He kind of thought everybody that was well brought up would feel the way any British person would feel.
Well, right, but that's the point. Human sympathy is not distributed in the way... we have these moral intuitions about right and wrong. I do not think human sympathy is distributed in the way that morality requires. So if you want to base morality on the distribution of human sentiment...
Not actual sympathy, but capability.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
capability.
Even that.
I mean, because, look, we have people that don't have the right sentiments, but we make judgments about them that they were capable of doing the right thing, and then we punish them for that. So having the right sentiments is not enough.
So let me ask you a question. So it seems to me, I'm not sure if I got you right or not. I'm maybe reading something into the way you're thinking about morality. It seems to me that you believe that if we reason rightly, right, if we're just rational creatures being moved by the force of the better reason, that, you know, when self-interest conflicts with morality, and it can conflict, but when self-interest conflicts with morality, just reasoning is going to see that morality should win out. Because it says, look, you got to be moved by self-interest over the demands of morality is to count your own interest unfairly or something like that. And that's irrational.
Well, there's a difference between being moved by something and whether there's a justification
that's
for doing it.
That's what I mean. You're right. Rationally moved.
So what I want to claim is that when self-interest conflicts with the morality, you can't give a good argument for self-interest over morality. And that's the justification question.
I see. So I want to go to this side of the room, but I want to go to the young man over there. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Hank Sanders.
And how old are you?
I'm 11.
Oh, wow, that's cool. Welcome to Vlog. What's your comment or question?
Okay, so my question is, isn't your depiction of rich and poor, is it just an ideology that's hiding in front of morality?
Wow. Take that, James.
Well, give that student an A. That's fantastic. No, I don't think it is. It is ideology. I mean, there is a conflict between rich and poor. You can work the numbers. It's growing in America, and it's a serious one, and it's going to pull us apart unless we do something about it.
I want to just pick up on that and go back to the young lady's question over here. Take a fairly concrete example, although maybe not the most moving one. Our tax system is a complete mess. Everybody agrees with that. There's nothing particularly just about it. What it should be, I don't know. But everybody agrees it's a mess. Now, some people use that as an excuse to say, well, it's a mess. It's not just. So the only thing to do is take every loophole you can find. Everything you can do legally is okay. I think that's wrong. I think the criticizability of the social structure does not eliminate the person that has hundreds of millions of dollars and hires lawyers to take advantage of loopholes that most people never hear about. I think that's immoral, even if the whole system is irrational and possibly immoral.
John, I agree with you about that, but there is a thing. In a morally imperfect world, which we often live in, the demands of morality can't always be a guide, because sometimes moral action in a morally imperfect world is fruitless.
Sometimes.
Well, sometimes. Yeah.
I'm going to take a stand here that's a little different. I'm going to say, yes, you can use those loopholes, and whatever you save in that, give it to the poor.
Well, that would be okay.
that's the moral thing.
Yes, there you go. We have time for one last question.
I'll give you Rami's address.
Hello, I'm Sebastian Orlander from Miami University, and I wanted to kind of ask a little, because you set up the discussion in this kind of binary way where it's either a conflict between the self-interest and interests of others, whereas, well, why do you want to exclude the middle there? Because I find that, because you exclude a whole tradition of, like, Aristotelian ethics where it's just, like, you can find that coming into there as well, and like, going in for the Aristotelian ethics, aren't you also, in a way, excluding this like historical awareness, at least, that you have to look at a specific socio-historical moment if you really want to understand morality, that you cannot just apply reason or else it just becomes a formula without content, that it doesn't really tell you what to do, and then the moral skeptic can just go, oh, I don't want to be moral anyway, so I just do whatever I want to.
Well, my view does move from rationality to equality, substantial equality. So that does tell you something about what to do. But you're right about the Aristotelian thing. The framework of my argument is more Kantian than Aristotelian. But happily, you can give another version of it that formulates, gets the same conclusion using Aristotelian themes. So I want an Aristotelian version of my argument. I want it to work in a Kantian tradition. I want it to work in an Aristotelian tradition.
Well, James, that's a big, tall order, and we're not going to be able to undertake it now, but maybe we'll have you back sometime, and I'm going to thank you for joining us. Well, it's been a scintillating conversation. Our guest has been James Sturba. He's a professor of philosophy from the University of Notre Dame, my alma mater. He's author of From Rationality to Equality. So, John, what are you thinking now? Why be moral?
We deal with a lot of different questions. This is one of the oldest, goes clear back to Plato, why be moral? I was a little surprised to hear something new said by James Sturba. Very original idea, puts together some things I hadn't thought of before. Not sure it's right, not sure it's wrong. Take some more research.
Yeah,
so,
well, you know,
it was a good outcome for me.
I'm pretty sure of something. You accuse me of being a moral skeptic.
Me?
And I'm not really a moral skeptic, but I actually think the sort of reason-giving power of morality is overrated. And the reason we be moral is because we care about morality, and we should raise ourselves to care about morality. But does it command us always? I just don't believe it. I think that's a hope. That's a hope. That's an aspiration. But I don't think... centuries of philosophy have shown we cannot make that hope.
In your
good.
Best moments, you sound like Hume to me.
Well, you know what? This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page, and you can follow our tweets on Twitter.
And you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website. That's philosophytalk.org. And now, we walk quickly down the straight and narrow with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there is no end of blame or blaming for the present economic predicament we're in. A lot of it boils down to two choices. It's either the fault of an inflated sense of entitlement, welfare queens showing up for food stamps and their Cadillacs, slowly bringing a great nation to its knees, or it's the fault of the 1% who just don't want to share with others. I'm more or less liberal in that I certainly don't think the pension plans of school teachers are playing a huge role in our ongoing economic turmoil. But the rich, I don't know. I've only known a few rich people in my life. One was the richest guy in my hometown who looked a little bit like a shrunken W.C. Fields, wore a little hat with a feather in it, and drove around town in a big white Cadillac. He liked young people and often offered to bankroll a promising young student's college education. To my knowledge, this never happened. But he would bring teens to his lake house for overnight visits, one of which I attended. The lake was lovely, but the house was falling apart, and it was quickly apparent, to me at any rate, that his interest in young people was more prurient than philanthropical. But hey, I got a trip to the lake out of the experience, and he never laid a hand on me. Not his type, I guess. We do have mixed feelings about our rich. Look at the culture. Look at our fictional rich. On the one hand, we have the villainous super-rich Lex Luthor, or Charles Montgomery Burns, or Cruella de Vil. There's Bond villain Hugo Drax, who wanted to use his wealth to destroy humanity and repopulate the earth with beautiful Aryans of his choosing. But there are also good one-percenters like Lara Croft, Scrooge McDuck, or Bruce Wayne. And we have the conflicted wealthy like Jay Gatsby, Tony Stark, or Pip's benefactor Magwitch in Great Expectations. We have the silly rich like Jed Clampett, Richie Rich, Thurston Howell III. What about the drunk billionaire Arthur, or Willy Wonka, Ebenezer Scrooge, Carlisle Cullen, the vampire billionaire? How about Nick and Nora Charles? How do they fit in? How about J.R. Ewing and Gordon Gekko, Ming the Merciless, another wealthy we love to hate? In the real world, there are the Kardashians, the Hilton offspring, the poor Kennedys, Patty Hearst, John Paul Getty III, who lost an ear and possibly some sanity to kidnappers. Are they paying a price for privilege? There's Lucius Malfoy. Who is John Galt? There's also John Hammond, who, you may recall, financed Jurassic Park, the fool. So it's a mixed bag in fiction as in life. On the one hand, we have Bill Gates, who turned his great fortune into a gigantic philanthropic organization. On the other hand, Steve Jobs, who apparently never gave anything to anybody. Museums and libraries and endowments and chairs and opera and ballet and theater all owe their lives to donations from men and women who may or may not have accumulated the money to donate off the blood, sweat, and tears of the working class. Wait a minute, do we even have a working class anymore? We probably need one. Can some rich guy make that happen, please? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Devin Strolovich, the Playtones.
Special thanks to David Borsma, the Elise Elliott Foundation, Wendy Stein, Aaron Levin, John Hayes, Leslie Halleck, David DeMoss, Ramona Ilya, and Maggie Pike, and the Philosophy Department at Pacific University.
Thanks also to Joel Groves, Jason Rappaport, Caitlin Ashmurrow, Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our Director of Research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the Friends of Philosophy Talk.
And from members of KALW, Public Radio for San Francisco. That's where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the views of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website. That's philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I want to talk to you today about a difficult topic that is close to me and closer than you might realize to you. I came to the UK 21 years ago as an asylum seeker. I was 21. I was forced to leave the Democratic Republic of the Congo, my home, where I was a student activist. I would love my children to be able to meet my family in the Congo. But I want to tell you what the Congo has got to do with you. But first of all, I want you to do me a favor. Can you all please reach into your pockets and take out your mobile phone? Feel that familiar weight. How naturally your fingers slide towards the buttons. Can you imagine your world without it? It connects us to our loved ones, our family, friends, and colleagues, at home and overseas. It is a symbol of an interconnected world. But what you hold in your hand leaves a bloody trail. And it all boils down to a mineral. Tantalum, mined in the Congo as coltan. It is an anti-corrosive heat conductor. It stores energy in our mobile phones, PlayStations, and laptops. It is used in aerospace and medical equipment as alloys. It is so powerful that we only need tiny amounts. It would be great if the story ended there. Unfortunately, what you hold in your hand has not only enabled incredible technological development and industrial expansion, but it has also contributed to unimaginable human suffering. Since 1996, over 5 million people have died in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Countless women, men, and children have been raped, tortured, or enslaved. Rape is used as a weapon of war, instilling fear and depopulating whole areas. The quest for extracting this mineral has not only aided, but it has fueled the ongoing war in the Congo. But don't throw away your phones yet. 30,000 children are enlisted and are made to fight in armed groups. The Congo consistently scores dreadfully in global health and poverty rankings. But remarkably, the UN Environmental Program has estimated the wealth of the country to be over $24 trillion. The state-regulated mining industry has collapsed, and control over mines has splintered. Coltan is easily controlled by armed groups. One well-known illicit trade route is that across the border to Rwanda, where Congolese tantalum is disguised as Rwandan. But don't throw away your phones yet, because the incredible irony is that the technology that has placed such unsustainable, devastating demands on the Congo is the same technology that has brought the situation to our attention. We only know so much about the situation in the Congo and in the mines because of the kind of communication the mobile phone allows. As with the Arab Spring, during the recent elections in the Congo, voters were able to send text messages of local polling stations to the headquarters in the capital, Kinshasa. And in the wake of the results, the diaspora has joined with the Carter Center, the Catholic Church, and other observers to draw attention to the undemocratic results. The mobile phone has given people around the world an important tool towards gaining their political freedom. It has truly revolutionized the way we communicate on the planet. It has allowed momentous political change to take place. So, we are faced with a paradox. The mobile phone is an instrument of freedom and an instrument of oppression. TED has always celebrated what technology can do for us. Technology in its finished form. It is time to be asking questions about technology. Where does it come from? Who makes it? And for what? Here I am speaking directly to you, the TED community, and to all those who might be watching on the screen, on your phone, across the world, in the Congo. All the technology is in place for us to communicate, and all the technology is in place to communicate this. At the moment, there is no clear fair trade solution. But there has been a huge amount of progress. The US has recently passed legislation to target bribery and misconduct in the Congo. Recent UK legislation could be used in the same way. In February, Nokia unveiled its new policy on sourcing minerals in the Congo. And there is a petition to Apple to make a conflict-free iPhone. There are campaigns spreading across university campuses to make their colleges conflict-free. But we're not there yet. We need to continue mounting pressure on phone companies to change their sourcing processes. When I first came to the UK 21 years ago, I was homesick. I missed my family and the friends I left behind. Communication was extremely difficult. Sending and receiving letters took months, if you were lucky. Often they never arrived. Even if I could have afforded the phone bills home, like most people in the Congo, my parents did not own a phone line. Today, my two sons, David and Daniel, can talk to my parents and get to know them. Why should we allow such a wonderful, brilliant, and necessary product to be the cause of unnecessary suffering for human beings? We demand fair trade food and fair trade clothes. It is time to demand fair trade phones. This is an idea worth spreading. Thank you.
Hey, what are you doing October 6th between, say, 10 and 4 p.m.? Well, the place to be is WHFR's 5th annual record show. The show will feature thousands of records.